Welcome to the MediaCap Magazine podcast. I'm your host, Mike Pigger, editor at the magazine. And today I'd like to welcome the Global Head of Research and Insights at We Are Social, Paul Greenwood, to the pod. Welcome, Paul.
Hi, how are you doing? Nice to see you.
Good for you to join us. I don't think we've had We Are Social on the pod before, actually. Come to think about it, you guys have written stuff for the magazine, but maybe not been on the podcast. So welcome.
I feel very special. Thanks for having me.
Good stuff. Today we're basically talking about a report that you guys brought out recently, the Next Gen Influence Report, Trends Defining a New Era of Brand and Creator Collaboration. I guess first off, how did the report come about? I think in it you guys mentioned there's been a permanent shift in the creator landscape. Was this a sudden or gradual thing? What sort of led to this? Is this the first time you've done this report?
Yeah, it's the first time we've done this report. We have had other reports out there that look at influencer marketing. And I guess what we saw when we've been working with influencers and creators and with our influencer marketing teams is that we do see this shift that's happened over the last, 15, 20 years. So the kind of first era of influence was about 15, 20 years ago. And they're the kind of like newspapers and newsletters and blogs that people were creating in terms of like text-based kind of content that was very factual and like a lot of knowledge and expertise was gone into them. And that slowly shifted away to the second era of influence, which was linked to the rise of Instagram, which became very visual. And so that was like peak travel influencer, peak beauty influencer. And that really had a massive impact on influencer marketing. But over the last, I'd say 3, 4, maybe 5 years, we're seeing this shift into the third era, which takes the two best bits of the previous era. So the expertise and knowledge of the first and the audio visual medium of the second and brings them both together. And so as a result, what we're seeing is like there's a shift from influencer to creator. And that's really interesting for us because creators are looking to showcase their kind of value, their ability to connect with audiences in a very different way that they have in the past. And it hasn't been a sudden shift. It's been a slow, gradual shift. But right now we feel we're on a kind of a cusp of something new and something big. And we know that the creator economy is like, it's meant to get to about 500 billion by 2030 as an economy. And so it's big business. And we know that brands and companies are putting their marketing dollars against that. And so we thought it was a good time to take a step back and look at what is happening and what's going to define the next era of influence going forward.
Yeah, it does sound like we're in this sort of weird time, I guess, where like, it feels like things move really, really fast and really slow at the same time, or maybe they just harken back to, I don't know. I literally commented today on LinkedIn that I feel like culturally we're sort of partly still stuck in the early 2000s in many ways. I don't know, in terms of tech and culture and things. But like you said, it's maybe taking different things from different periods of social.
That's a really interesting thing to say, because actually the first trend, which is the right to reinvention, one of the main drivers of that is nostalgia. And typically nostalgia works on a 25, 30 year basis. So like people will go and reassess culture, you know, music, fashion, film of that generation. And that's what's happening right now offline. So I don't know if you tried to get Oasis tickets. I feel like everyone did a few weeks ago, but like the Y2K movement in terms of fashion, that's what people are doing right now. But when you come to online culture, what people are doing, they're basically engaging in near-term nostalgia, which is 3 to 5 years ago. And so offline, you're looking 20, 30 years back, but online, you're only looking 3, 5 years back. And so that's why when you say things feel fast and slow at the same time, it can probably seem like that, because online, it's quite near and faster, but offline, it's much slower. Yeah, I think that's a really interesting thing for the right to reinvention, which is one of the trends in the report, which is all around, I guess it's around people having more fluid identities online as they grow up online, and in particular creators. So in the past, you know, like a celebrity or, you know, a well-known individual would have like a very static personality and brand. So if you think about Tom Hanks, he's been the same individual since the 80s, you know, like in through the 90s, noughties, you know what you're going to get with Tom Hanks. But what we're seeing with creators and influencers is that they were like kids when they, you know, they became really famous online. And so if they're like 14, 15, 16, and they've been online for the last 10 years, they're going to have a huge transformation. I know like every other person does, like as a 16-year-old versus a 26-year-old, I was a very different individual. And so that's what we're seeing play out in influencer marketing and the creator economy, is that these creators are slowly evolving online in real time. And now audiences are expecting an evolution. And they think that being a chameleon and changing your personal brand is more authentic than keeping a static personal brand. And that, like I said, is being driven by that near-term nostalgia where people are re-engaging with creators that they knew 3-5 years ago and reassessing their relationships with them.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, I guess, yeah, if we sort of get into that, you obviously talked about it a little bit, but the first section of the report, the right to reinvention. Yeah, the kind of, so what a theme we've got coming up for the magazine in November is marketing generations and sort of looking at how our relationship with kind of the marketing and the media changes as we move through different stages of life. Originally, we were like thinking about, how marketing tends to obviously focus very much on the youth all the time. And but then that's been flipped on its head a little bit. And we've had some pieces on the magazine talking about older influencers kind of reclaiming their youth or just sort of creating a new version of themselves, on TikTok, for example, which is quite interesting to see. Are you seeing much of that sort of stuff in a creator sense, like different people doing different things at different stages in their life?
Yeah, definitely. So that's also the other part of right to reinvention is that people are more age inclusive and different generations are more age inclusive. So one of the reasons that is because Generation Alpha is about to come of age online in the next 2 to 3 years. And as a result, Gen Z are no longer seen as the cool kids anymore. There's this other generation. And so they start to widen their perspectives and start to think about what it means to get older. And so they start to look to older generations. And as a result, exactly what you said, people are engaging with older influencers, like Grandpa Core became a thing in the last year or so. In Germany, there's a huge creator out there who's like this granddad who basically he gets given some of the coolest clothes out there and he just wears them and he's become this cult figure. And people are more open to seeing those individuals in their feeds. People are doing that. There's also like people who've basically started as like I said, as an influencer. So there's a lady called Sophie Aris. She features in the report and she was like a gym bunny. She was always like at the gym, working out, being an influencer. But what happened was she then became a mum. And so she then had to transition from being like this like high impact individual to like, these are the daily routines that I have as a mum. And what was interesting with Shaw, the deodorant brand, is that they continued to work with her from being a gym bunny into being like this mum, because they knew that actually the audiences themselves that followed her would also be going and making that transition. So it's quite an interesting space where brands can you work with influencers through the different life stages. A really like interesting example was Gucci's relationship with Harry Styles. So Harry Styles, I think everyone knows who he is, but like he has quite a gender fluid kind of like fashion sense. And Gucci wanted to like reposition themselves and challenge the kind of outmoded versions of what fashion could look like in terms of masculine and feminine. And so they saw that he was doing that and they started working with him as a brand ambassador to help them, one, make that transition from these kind of, this is male fashion, this is female fashion, but also target a younger audience. So yeah, we are seeing people at different life stages, working with brands in different ways, and people being more open to older generations. I was reading a trend report recently where they were talking about older generations right now are engaging with like youth culture. And so like I went to see Chapel Rowan on Friday night, and like I'm a middle-aged gay man. So like it's not as if like she probably appeals to a much younger demographic, but I saw myself in that. And the other trend report was saying like, but actually younger generations are engaging with like nostalgia in a much more deep way. So going back and reviewing Friends. And that's quite an interesting, tension there in terms of older people acting like young people and young people acting like older people. So yeah, it's a really interesting space for a brand to play in with that kind of how you target different generations and should you be targeting just the youth or whether you could be targeting older generations.
Wow, my partner would be very jealous. They tried to get Chapel Rowan tickets and weren't able to. Were you singing along to all the songs, or because I heard that some people went along and they were like fans, but they didn't maybe know the songs, and everybody else did totally knew them all. So it was like they were kind of a bit like, oh, what's going on?
Yeah, I am a big fan of Chappell Roan from last year. So yeah, she's great. So I did know a lot of the songs.
Good stuff. Yeah, it's I was wondering with the sort of the reinvention of a creator creators, where do they lose half their fans if they, you know, you talked about the Jim Bunny to the mum, and it's as do people stick with them? Like, how loyal are followers in the spaces these days?
Well, I guess that depends on the creator themselves and the relationship that they've developed with their follower base. The great thing about creators and influencers is that they probably know the internet better than anyone else, and they certainly know their audiences better than anyone else. So I think they're very conscious of, in terms of those transitions, in terms of not losing audiences and not losing followers and maintaining that relationship with their existing followers whilst also evolving over time. So it's rare that you will see a big drop in follower bases if someone changes. If that happens, it's been quite a dramatic shift and a twist. But most creators are savvy enough to know that it can't be an overnight thing. It has to be a gradual transition. And obviously, their followers will also be going on the same life, like the same journey throughout their lives at the same time.
I suppose that's a good point. And one of the other things I wanted to ask in terms of reinvention, the internet these days obviously will be quick to call people out and sort of bring them down if they're doing bad things or wrong things, which is fair.
Yep.
But people do love a redemption story. So I wondered if you ever sort of see that in terms of creators reinventing themselves in terms of, I don't know, turning over new leaves and fans coming back to them saying, okay, we forgive you, or does that happen much?
I think it does happen a lot. Like, if you look at Logan Paul, like a few years ago, he was being called out for some really kind of like problematic kind of content that he was putting out there. And now he's gone from strength to strength. He has Prime, his drinks brand, he's boxing, he's fighting Mike Tyson. Like, he's still popular and people still like him. But so I think that redemption arc, like you said, is like, it's something that plays out time and time again in storytelling. And we do see that playing out in social and with creators. Charlotte Crosby from Geordie Shore. Do you remember her? Like, she's
no.
now like.
So, never watched Geordie Shore.
you've never lived. But like Geordie Shore, I think a lot of people know, it's quite a raunchy kind of following some like young 20-somethings around Newcastle, and it was pretty explicit. She's transformed herself into like a momfluencer. So she is like, she has made that dramatic plot twist, and people are still engaging with her. I'm not saying that she had to be apologetic for her previous. A previous kind of exploits, but like people do tend to are happy when people change as well. So I think redemption stories are really good, and yeah, people are buying into them.
Yeah, I laugh at Geordie Shore, but then to be fair, I do know that I think it's Logan Paul, his partner's a Dutch speed skater. Although I might be confusing with Jake Paul, so I'm not sure. One of the Pauls. So ignore that point if I've got it completely wrong. But actually, leading on, maybe it all leads on to our the next stage of the report, relatable realism, which our October theme is out of touch. So we trying to explore sort of how marketing and the media, how in touch or out of touch are they with actual people in the world? I mean, they get accused of it all the time, but is it getting better or worse, or is it kind of the same? And I think you mentioned that people are more in the content that people are more connecting to is less about glamour and luxury and more about calm and stability. I don't know if that's just within wellness or just general life. Can we sort of dig into that a little bit?
Yeah. So this one relates definitely to lifestyle content. There's another trend that we talk about later called extreme influence, which is around entertainment content. And I take those two together because entertainment's becoming more fast, frenetic, extreme, and lifestyle's becoming more relaxed, chill, and less competitive. And it feels like in the influencer marketing space and creator economy, it's pulling the internet apart a little bit. And the reason why lifestyle content is becoming more relaxed, more chill, is because aspirations have changed. Like, if you think about it, especially for younger generations, like trying to get on the housing ladder, there's a cost of living crisis, you know, there's, you know, difficulties in trying to find romantic relationships online. And even if you are able to get on the housing ladder, you know, you're home might be underwater in 20 years. Like, these are big, big kind of existential kind of crises that people are dealing with on the day to day. And we've talked in other reports about the world's going through a perma crisis or is in a perma crisis. And as a result, people's aspirations have changed, not from wanting this really luxury, high-end lifestyle, just to having more like stability and just something that's calm and easy and I guess something that you can like that is not going to fluctuate differently. And so that's why creators and influencers are now adapting their content to be more chill, more relaxed, and less competitive. We see it playing out in other areas as well. Like, we work with a lot of sports brands, and we've seen the rise of soft sports, and you know, like pickleball, like hiking, like people want to take the competitive nature out of sports and just be there for communion and connection. So that this trend really talks to that.
Yeah, we've had pieces in the magazine over the last couple of years around a lot to do with coziness. That comes up a lot, and we haven't actually done a piece about it, but I did want to at some point talk about kind of the rise of a type of media that kind of gets ignored a little bit, which is board games, and it's in fact massive. One of the people that kind of got into them more with the pandemic, I guess, you know, we were locked down at home and stuff, but it did make me realize just how huge that industry actually is. And I get a lot of board game emails now, but so many of them are to do with coziness and wellness, and you know, and I suppose you see that in gaming as well, with like I literally saw a TikTok today where somebody was complaining that they wanted cozy games that weren't farming games because they're always farming. But yeah, obviously the gaming community settled on cozy equals farming and gardening and stuff.
Yeah, I think what's really interesting about that is like in gaming and in board games, it's about participation and like, and what it does, it gives you structure and rules around how to participate. So like, I'm a big board game fan. I like love Catan, you know, like all that, but it's an opportunity to spend time with people in a structured way where you don't feel like you have to have a conversation and you're going to run out of conversation. I think that's what's interesting about those kind of phenomenon is like, it gives you that kind of, these are the rules and the parameters in which you communicate and you bond and you talk. And I think that's why it's so successful. We're planning our next trend report. And one of the kind of trends is around like structured kind of communication and connection. And I feel that those two things that you said really play into that.
Yeah, I imagine there's a lot of that in gaming as well. Because you can filter a lot of video games and board games by, in terms of what you're trying to get, by collaborative rather than competitive, which is like quite a key distinction, I think, because half the time you're like, well, actually competitive is quite intense and exhausting, whereas actually I want to work together with my partner or my friend or whatever on this common goal. And it's kind of nice because it's like something simple, like, I don't know, growing a garden or saving the gnomes in the forest or something cute like that. As the world seems to get more and more crazy, it feels like the antidote to that or something that the sort of, you know, cuts through it a little bit.
But like, and I think you were asking about like whether like marketers are out of touch with like the consumers that they're meant to be like targeting. And
that's our theme for the upcoming month.
And I don't think they are, because like you've been talking about coziness, we've been talking about soft sports, slow culture, and we've been talking a lot with our clients about those things. And I think they're aware of the cost of living crisis. I think they're aware of like the demands of on people in the real world, and so people do change their marketing to focus on escapism or joy, or you know, like, and I feel like you have seen a shift in comms coming out from brands around those kind of big kind of those kind of more wholesome elements that they can target. So yeah, the wholesome internet's also a big thing as well, and that would play into the relatable realism trend around influencer marketing.
Yeah, that makes sense. I guess next we have on the report is influential allies, people using philanthropy on for online clout, and people sort of becoming skeptical of online posturing. Again, this kind of feels like it ties into authenticity. Again, it's probably lots of things do, but what did you discover in this section when you were putting it together?
So this is really interesting, is that I guess allyship is really important for underrepresented and diverse communities. But what we're seeing is that a lot of creators will, express the same values as those underrepresented communities, but actually what the people want is more action and tangible action. So they want to, like, it's all right to, you know, like, talk the talk, but you have to walk the walk as a brand or as a creator. And that's what we're really seeing play out in this trend. The biggest example, I guess, in the world of someone doing this is Mr. Beast. Like, he has a lot of content that he gives money away, he helps certain communities, but what he's really doing is profiteering from those communities. Like, he'll be monetizing those videos, and people are very savvy to that and aware of that and sensitive to that, especially if you're one of those communities. And so there's been, and also on social, like, I think you were talking about it earlier, but like, people are very quick to call people out when they feel like something's not right. And so that's what's really driving this trend, is like, people are, and creators are saying that they're allies, but not really helping the communities. And then those communities are very quick to call them out. And so this is interesting in terms of, like, what does it mean for a brand if you're going to work with those communities and want to target them? How can you make a tangible difference to them? And I think that's what people are looking for and really seeking out here.
Yeah, it probably feels like one of the most, not inflammatory, but, like, I don't know, kind of sensitive sections, perhaps, of the report, in terms of if people are looking to, businesses are looking to work in these spaces, I guess they've probably got to tread the most carefully or be the most considered, maybe, in their approach.
Yeah, and I think that's always been the case. Like, I think sometimes when, like, when you, I think in marketing, sometimes having diverse people in certain areas of the world in your marketing is like a radical act in and of itself. But in the more progressive markets, people are pushing beyond that. And they want to see more complicated and messy kind of depictions of life. And they also want some support as well. So there's a really good example of this was H&M, and they had a collaboration with Buy From A Black Woman. And they put those products in their store and gave the profits back to the people who created them, which were Black women. And that showed that, one, obviously they could talk about it in an authentic way, in a genuine way, but also show that they're making a difference to individuals as well. I think that's what's important. It's about representation, and representation doesn't have to be tokenism. It has to be something more than that.
Yeah, which but I'm pretty sure every single year we will have some kind of article on stuff for Pride Month where it's like, don't just slap a rainbow on it and things like that. Yeah, it kind of feels every single year you have to sort of keep reiterating the same sort of message. And a lot of brands do get it, but a lot still don't, which I guess is why you still have a job, right? Because you got to be like, right, okay, you need to be doing this, not this. But
yeah, no, that happens a lot in Pride. And I sometimes am in two minds about that. I'm sometimes thinking, like, yeah, it is rainbow washing. It's, you know, just the easiest thing that a corporate could do is slap a rainbow on it. But then, like, if a young kid sees that and then goes, oh, well, you know, there's some kind of connection there, and they see it, then I think, well, actually, that's not a bad thing, you know, especially if they come from quite an insular lifestyle. So, like, yeah, brands should be doing more. Sometimes it just comes across as really tone deaf. Like, it just feels jarring. And I think that's when people are going to call it out.
Yeah, if it's like not particularly thought through as a plan or anything. I guess the next section is we've got is credible creativity, which kind of almost goes a bit hand in hand with the last section in a way, I think at least. But in terms of it's about repackaging vulnerability as entertainment, which sounds a little bit exploitative, but maybe it's more empowering than that. People being as real as they could be. Is that what this section's about? Or
it's around, like, I guess, more human nature. So, like, vulnerability is obviously part of human, like, nature, but it's more than that. Where basically what this one does is it allows a brand to express more human emotions that it wouldn't be able to express, but through the creator and the influencer. So I guess if you look at advertising in the last 10 years or so, it feels like it has become very sanitized. And that's partly because people are quick to call brands out if they're doing something wrong, like we talked about in influential allies and also in relatable realism. But I guess the difference is here, it can be about vulnerability, but it can be about, you know, like taking more risks in what they talk about. And I think that's what's really interesting about this, is that because creators and influencers are one step removed from the brand, they can take more risks. And that could be, they could be showing up as being messier. They could be talking about things that are seen as risque. They could be showing vulnerability. And so it's quite a fun trend, if I'm honest. It's like, you can be quite subversive with it. You can be quite silly with it. You can be quite random with it. And so, yeah, it is... It's. I don't think it's exploitative the way that it's actioned. It's more around how can we take more risks as a brand, and just being that one step removed in terms of like coming in for criticism. So yeah, I think that the example we have in the report, and it features heavily throughout the report, is Marc Jacobs. Marc Jacobs is like chronically online. Whoever's doing their social comms, I think it might just be an intern, but they're working with some really interesting partnerships. So they work with Sylvanian Dramas, which is like Sylvanian families, and they're talking about addiction and going to rehab and staging an intervention, which doesn't seem to feel like it should work, but it's because it's being told by Sylvanian families, it's like, it's almost palatable. And so people aren't going to criticize them for it. And it's that kind of subversiveness that I think people are seeking. Like, people don't want to have branded content served to them. They want to have fun native content, and brands can work with creators in that way to serve them interesting, entertaining content that's more credible and less advertising.
I mean, that sounds a good thing. Definitely. I just wondered, like, how does it actually connect to the brand? I mean, our September theme is fashion, so I know you mentioned Gucci already, and Marc Jacobs is interesting, but I was just wondering how on earth does Marc Jacobs connect their business to that material?
So in Sylvanian Families, there's the little Marc Jacobs bags throughout the content. But like, they do some, Marc Jacobs does some pretty unexpected things, and it's not always clear what the link is. So I think one of the things that they did as well is that they worked with a guy called Jack the Great, and he is a little, I think about 10, 11, 12 year old guy who like gets super excited when lights get switched off in stores. And so what they did is they just had him come to one of their stores and switch the lights off. And obviously Marc Jacobs he's in one of their stores, so it's plastered all over his content, but it's almost thinking about, but yeah, it was just basically creating like a big moment for them. And there's no obvious link to like Jack the Lad being in Marc Jacobs' purchaser or like want to be a consumer, but I think they just understand what's happening on social so well, and they're able to jump on like creators who are blowing up and having a moment and work with them in a really authentic way. And I think partly what's really interesting about Marc Jacobs is because they do give up a lot of creative control to the people that they work with, and I think that's what feels authentic about it and why it works. It might not work for a lot of brands. You probably need to figure out your place in culture. You need to figure out what trends and creators you can work with and what parameters you can work in. And then, because you're not going to be able to react to every single trending moment, but once you have those parameters and those frameworks and strategies in place, you then need to the infrastructure underneath to be able to spot them and then activate in a really fast turnaround. But with Marc Jacobs, I'm not sure there is a link. I think it's just that they understand what being chronically online is, and their audience are chronically online. And so it's maybe just that they know that their consumers will also be looking at that content as well.
Yeah, I mean, it makes me think, we did a podcast, one of our writers, Faris Yaqub, he was our guest host, and he interviewed Andy Pearson at Liquid Death a little while ago. And Andy was talking about how they want to sort of evolve into, or he already kind of sees them as a sort of an entertainment company rather than a water beverage brand, which is kind of interesting because it's almost like he was talking about them doing everything in-house and working almost like as a kind of an entertainment studio. They want to release an animated show, for example, that's got very, very little to do with anything. It's so like almost, it's such a loose connection to water in the end. It's almost like you've evolved into such a way. And I just wonder if like more brands need to sort of see themselves as more entertainers rather than, you know, happen to sell some products kind of thing, but at the same time, they're trying to entertain more than anything else.
Yeah, like it's Red Bull. Red Bull's like extreme sports, entertainment. And social itself has been shifting as well from being social, so making connections with three people you know, to being an entertainment platform. So when with the rise of TikTok and its impact on the other social media platforms, we're moving away from the social graph to the interest graph. And the social graph is like who you know. So on Facebook, you will probably know every single person that you connected with. On Instagram, you'll probably know some of your family and friends are on there, but you probably follow celebrities. You might follow some of the like influencers. TikTok is all about the interest that you follow, not the people that you follow. And as a result, we are seeing a shift away from influencers being a distribution service. So where brands would give them their content and they would just pump it out to their follower base, to creators becoming entertainers and shaping what entertainment looks like on the social platforms, because most of those platforms are becoming entertainment hubs. And so for a brand, it makes a lot of sense to start acting like an entertainment and provider. It's easier said than done for some brands, but like you do need to think about it strategically and go, how can we play into that space? Because the social platforms are there for entertainment, to relieve boredom, you know, to find something interesting to learn. And so, yeah, I feel like it makes a lot of sense for brands to start thinking like an entertainment first brand.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, but I think we're going to hopefully just keep digging into that more and more at the magazine. I suppose on a side note, have you seen Nutter Butter's TikTok? I saw it the other day. I was like, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Interestingly, someone sent me that in an email this morning. literally this morning, I came in and started reading about it. Yeah, it is. It's brands like that are like we see brands playing in a new role, in a different role, and in social and with their consumers. Like Duolingo, like their social channels are similar. Ryanair back in the, like on TikTok is just, it's nothing to do with aviation. It's just memes, laughing at self-awareness, laughing at themselves. And people enjoy that. And there's going to be some attribution back to the brand and some change in positivity and sentiment to the brand because of it.
Yeah, definitely. Scrub Daddy is another one. Sponges. I mean,
I've not seen that one.
Look up Scrub Daddy. Yeah. One of our writers wrote about it at one point. I didn't know much about it either. But yeah, sponges that somehow are amazing and hilarious. Okay. Great account. Okay, final section, and then I guess we can wrap up. The final section, extreme influence, which you mentioned earlier, and kind of makes me think of some sort of Black Mirror episode. but you talk about creators going to extremes to cut through in this sort of sea of sameness on the kind of dead internet. What's this about, and kind of what challenges are they facing? Why are they going to extremes?
So, yeah, I think there's a couple of things. So this is specifically around entertainment, and yeah, it's around, there's been a long conversation around how the internet and culture more broadly has become quite flat, and everything seems the same. Algorithms serve you the same content. You know, people are lacking originality when it comes to creativity, especially on the internet. And that's partly because there's so much content out there, and there's so much content that is created not by humans as well. And there's also so many people can become creators now because of that shift, like I said, from the social to the interest graph, that you could become a creator overnight. And a lot of the aesthetics seem the same when you look at creators. So you've got the amount of content, who's producing it, and the kind of tools that you use to create the content all feeling the same. And so everything looks the same and can feel the same. And what creators are seeing is that if they can produce content that goes to the margins, that can feel extreme and to the fringe, they can cut through, and the algorithm will favor that because people will engage with it. So we're seeing creators like in terms of like human feats. So running the whole length of Africa, that's a huge thing that not many people would have documented previously, but you can go on that journey with them. There's a creator in there called Max Webb, who's like a really cool parkour guy that like showcases like how he creates those kind of big kind of like jumps from one building to the next. We're seeing just people be really, really weird. John Pork is like an AI generated pig that is a travel influencer. Like had a huge kind of like meme with John Pork calling, but like people are doing some really strange and bizarre things. And I think the bizarreness is like driven by younger generations. So like we're seeing Gen Alpha come around and engage with content that's around like really absurd and surreal behavior. And TikTok was like kind of ground zero for that. That was where it'll grow and blow up. So like, do you know Skibidi Toilets? They were a thing last year.
I heard the name before. I've never actually looked up what's going on there though.
Yeah, it's basically these monsters that live in the loo, and they come out and fight these raging battles repeatedly and repeatedly. And it's just like, it's nonsense. It's meaningless. But they're some of the largest growing accounts on YouTube and on TikTok. And they have a cult following with like Gen Alpha. So like 10, 13, 14 year old kids. So it's that kind of weird behavior that generation are leaning into, and that kind of humor. So you get weirdness in that way, but you get these huge human feats of like endurance and going further and further and further. And people are really engaging with that because they want to see things that have never been seen before. And like, even on like small things, like the edit of a video, it's becoming more frenetic. It's fast paced. There's like lots of overlays. There's many different like movements within it, which you wouldn't have had maybe like 5 years ago. And what's interesting about that is you see that then playing out on advertising, like on linear TV and in like the real world. So like TVCs, you're seeing that kind of edit move from social into broader advertising.
Yeah, kind of. It makes me think a little bit of maybe like the early to mid 90s, and it stuff being remixed from that period, where there was quite a lot of like surrealism and weirdness, especially on like kids' TV and cartoons and things like that. But I remember like Games Master, you know, I don't know if you remember it, but the giant floating head, which was the host. If you go and watch it back now, it's actually pretty freaky and scary and trippy. But just stuff like that, I wonder if it's kind of getting remixed. You know, I don't think we saw as much sort of surrealism and weirdness maybe in the 2000s as maybe the 90s, but I don't know.
Yeah, potentially. Like we have been looking back at the 90s and advertising around that. And like, especially around when I was talking about like, sometimes it feels like advertisers become sanitized. Like when you look back at the 90s, PlayStation were doing some really interesting things in terms of like their advertising and taking those risks. And I feel like in extreme influence is a way of, I think it's not exactly the same as what was happening in the 90s, but it's similar in terms of creators and influencers trying to capture some of that kind of that riskiness to it. So yeah, it's an interesting one.
Like you've been tangoed, the tango guy, they brought him back, didn't they? I think in recent times. He was gone for years.
Yeah, that was, and he was, depending on which tango flavor, it was either like bright orange or like,
yeah, it was like purple. Slapping people in the face or whatever. And I don't know, it sounds a little bit like that period, or I don't know, maybe silliness or wackiness.
Yeah, randomness, I think. Like it is, yeah, I think it is silliness. And it's play, like this one's, you can take it to like human feet, or you can take it to, you know, experimentation and playfulness. And I think that's the nice thing about it. So yeah, it's a nice one. I like all the trends. The last two are like the funnest ones to engage with as a brand. You can do some interesting stuff. You can push creativity. And I think that's, yeah, I think it's a nice thing to think about. And obviously then when a brand's choosing which influencers to work with, then depending on where you want to go as a brand, you would have to like have the strict criteria of who those individuals are.
Would you typically see, I know we've got to wrap up in a sec, but just one quick question, I guess. Would you typically see it as brands kind of picking and choosing sort of one of these areas or two of these areas to go into, or can they sort of, I don't know, straddle them all, so to speak?
So I think you would pick a few. I don't think you would try and pick all of them. I think you would be trying to do too much there. I think in terms of like, if you're thinking about, like, you could definitely like work into like relatable realism in terms of like who they are and maybe like influential allies. You know, if people are like going on journeys themselves through their life stages, like we talk a lot about people transitioning in the report and showcasing that journey, and people are engaging in that journey, not because of the destination, but because they want to be taken on it. I think things like relatable realism, I think right to reinvention and, you know, extreme influence. And if someone's reinvented themselves to do something more extreme, Logan Paul's a great example of that, from being a gamer to a boxer. Like you can overlap some of these. I wouldn't try and do too much though, because I think you need to land your brand messaging, and you need to do that consistently.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, yeah, we've got to wrap up now, but we'll put some links in the show notes to the report if it's available for... Is it available? Is it available for people to see and download and things?
Yep, it's available to download.
Good stuff. We'll put a link in the notes to that and anything else that you guys are up to that you want to point people to, and any future work you guys are doing. Just for now, just thank you so much, Paul, for coming on the Media Cat Magazine podcast.
Thanks for having me.